The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wigginton. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wigginton.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. One quick announcement, and that is we're using the 60-minute format for today. So, again, please watch the clock, and if you have an email question or a phone call for our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, please make sure you do it while we are still doing the show. So, again, we're using the 60-minute format for today. Our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. Please remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and you'll be brought up on air as quickly as possible. You can also reach us through email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can comment on our blog, and as soon as you hit the send button, I will get that comment or question. And to do that, go to our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. And this is the first program listed, which is also the archive and blog page for this program. So open it up and scroll all the way down to the bottom for comments. Please remember that you do not have to be logged in to an account at Discuss to post a blog comment or question. You can easily do so as a guest. And while you're at thespaceshow.com, the detailed website newsletter for the week has been posted. You'll see that over on the right side of the website homepage. So check it out. Also scroll down and you'll see the future programs planned. And we're closing out on the first quarter of 2019. I can't believe time is moving that fast. And then we have a full week of programming. So you'll see that listed in the website newsletter as well. Remember that everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily and rapidly download these shows. There is a Space Show store for logo wear and other Space Show items. And to access that store, it is in the upper left menu under support. And you'll see the Cafe Press store. There is also a Listen Live button in that upper left menu. So that tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs and how to listen to archived programs, podcasts, and also Amazon's Alexa programs. And the TuneIn player is embedded on the site, which is used for Alexa. So if you have any questions, you can email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can send those instructions around to other people who may be interested in listening to the Space Show but are really not familiar with all the ways they can listen to programs, either live or archived. And then a couple of other quick things. The program is trademarked and copyrighted, and you're free to circulate our programs, although it's a lot easier just to send someone a URL. There are a couple of rules, and that they include don't do anything commercial with the program. Don't do edits, cuts, clips, and put them up on YouTube or any other website, even your own. And written transcripts are still not available, and please don't do them. And we appreciate your cooperation with all of this. Podcasting is through gigadial.net. We're in iTunes and a host of other places. If you have any podcasting questions, email me again at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please do remember we are a listener-supported nonprofit radio program. We're a 501c3, as the saying goes. And if you are a federal U.S. taxpayer and you donate to the Space Show, you do get a tax donation for your gift. If you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax donation, as we are a public benefit corporation in California. We are listener supported, which means that your support keeps the program going. So we do appreciate and we need your support. And if you have any questions, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Visit our nonprofit site, onegiantleapfoundation.org, and you'll get more information about our 501c3. And also, if you're interested in our advisory board, which is being reconstituted for 2019, then on the One Giant Leap site, over on the left menu, click on Team, and then there'll be a drop-down menu. Click on Advisory Board, and you will see the guidelines and instructions for being part of the advisory board. If this interests you, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We will soon be posting the names of the new revised advisory board starting this year, 2019. And if you are interested, we'd be glad to talk to you and get your feedback. So please do email me. We do also have sponsors for our program. And as this is a shorter program, I just want to thank our sponsors rather than read their detailed message. So we do thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, MoonWorks, AIAA, the Space Development Organization, Celestis, and the Space Plan. You can see their banner ads going across the Space Show homepage. Remember, if you are a sponsor, you can modify and change those banner ads as often as you like. And I would suggest you click on them from time to time, because the companies that have those banner ads do change the underlying content from time to time. If you're interested in being a sponsor, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So I'm very happy to bring to the Space Show for the first time Laura Forsick. Her company, which is a consulting company, is Astrolytical, and they focus on space industry policy and science. She is also the executive director of the nonprofit Georgia Space Alliance, and she has had an interest in the moon and exploring stars since way back when. She has researched astrophysics and planetary science at three NASA centers. She has done parabolic zero-G flights, earned NASTAR suborbital astronaut wings, and much, much more. She also ran the Florida office of the startup that all of you are familiar with, Swiss Space Systems. And she is in the process of writing a new book, which I'm very interested in talking to her about and reading when it becomes finalized, The Rise of Space Age Millennials, The Space Aspirations of a Rising Generation. This is part of a crowdfunding program that already is funded well in advance of when her crowdfunding program ends. Laura, welcome to the Space Show. It's very nice to have you on board. How are you today?
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm doing great.
Let's start out and a couple of quick things. Why do a book on space age millennials?
This book idea came to me about 3 years ago. I never saw myself as a book author, so it was a bit of a surprise to me that I took this on. I'm an older millennial, and there's the stereotypes and the stories that come out about millennials are this, millennials are that, and why is there negative? And I found that it didn't really reflect me or my millennial peers. And so I wanted to dive into that and look at it from a space point of view. And I wanted to get a bit of the perspective from individual millennials. And so I interviewed 100 millennials, either working or planning to work. They're still in school, who have some unique perspectives. Some of them are still students. Some of them are entry-level employees. Some of them are founders of their own companies. And I wanted to get their idea of what their work styles are like, what their perspectives are, what they feel about the future, how they think that the millennial generation is going to progress the space industry and the space sector, and didn't directly ask it, but under the surface, I wanted to dive into some of those stereotypes and try to understand you know, is there any truth to them? And it was a very interesting project that I took on. And I'm very grateful for the 100 millennials who spoke with me, and looking forward to getting this out there for people to read it.
And you told me before the show that you're hoping for a release date of around April, correct?
Yes, that's what we're aiming for.
So we have made fun of lots of millennials on the space show.
Easy to do.
And there was a song that somebody did that was parodied off of a really famous song. I forget what it was, but it was really hilarious. And you've probably heard it, although I can't remember the name of it or who the singer was that did it, but also made fun of the millennials. But in talking to people at space conferences and on the space show, what I have found is that if a millennial is actually engaged in a hard science or engineering graduate school program, they are not to be compared with millennials in general, because they're much more serious, much more studious, much more goal-oriented and accomplishment-oriented. And there doesn't seem to be as much of a distinction between a millennial in that type of a graduate school program or post-grad program as with the rest of the millennial group. I don't know if you found anything like that to be true or not, but I'd like your thoughts on that.
So I'm a scientist with a physics background, so I do dive a little bit into my biases. And for example, sample bias, I've got, you know, only the people that I reached out to, and only the people who are interested in these careers, and only people who agree to talk to me. So there's a significant sample bias there in that I'm not just talking to anybody on the street. But I also am not a social scientist, so I can't really compare, you know, the millennial generation as a whole compared to the people I spoke with. I spoke individually because I felt that you can't argue with someone's individual experiences and perspectives and opinions. You know, people can disagree with those opinions, but you can't argue that those opinions exist. And so I really wanted to dive into those individuals. That way we can get some personal perspectives and the points of view from these individuals that I spoke with. Now, when it comes to science and engineering focus, I actually on purpose reached out to non-STEM majors or non-STEM backgrounds. Because one of the things that I talk a lot with, I mentor students as well, and one of the things they do is I speak to them about how they can get involved in the space industry, and you don't need to be a scientist or an engineer. I myself, I love science. I am a scientist, but there's so much more that's out there that is involved in the space industry. And so I purposely spoke with educators, educators, and others who are also involved in space.
What did you find out? Is space a really hot topic in this age group, if I can refer to it as an age group?
And let's clarify that, because I did these interviews back in 2016. At that point, it was end of high school through mid-30s. So now fast forward 3 years, they're all out of high school. So you've got, you know, university students on through even almost to 40 years old. So we're not talking about kids. We're talking about young adults and reaching this level. Kind of a wide age range there. Now, again, I only spoke with people who were interested in a space career in some way, shape, or form. Some of them were scientists. Some of them were engineers. Some of them were, you know, in business and starting their own companies. So, yeah, everyone was absolutely enthusiastic. In fact, one of those questions that I asked was almost a throwaway question. You know, how passionate are you about your job, or is it just a paycheck? And universally, everyone talked about how it wasn't a paycheck. In fact, some people laughed at the question because they were graduate students. You know, a paycheck as a grad student. So sample size-wise, limited to just 100 people that I spoke with were very enthusiastic about what they do.
I'm getting some cutting out on your phone. So is it just a regular cell phone, or are you connected?
It is. It's an iPhone.
Yeah. Well, Apple is cutting out a little bit. So you're not connected through Wi-Fi or anything like that. It's just your regular cell phone.
I am connected through Wi-Fi, but we're not doing like a FaceTime. So
no.
I'm in the best place that I could be for the signal. I can go outside if need be, but it's cold.
No, that would probably be worse outside, but I am getting some cutting out, unfortunately.
Sorry.
Is there any, I hate to almost ask this in today's age, but did you find any gender differences in their attitudes towards space?
the gender differences that I found had to do with those intersectional topics such as sexism. That came up actually several times throughout my conversations, where women, including myself, have had experiences that sometimes positive but mostly negative about working in the space industry and not being taken seriously or sexual harassment and that kind of thing. So those are the kind of gender differences I saw, where not a single man mentioned that in the interviews, but quite a lot of women. And I did on purpose try to reach out to a diversity of candidates. So I spoke with quite a number of women, and I didn't stick to just the United States either. I tried to reach out to other countries to get different perspectives. It's always a touchy subject because you don't know whether that is something that is specific to that person or whether something that is, you know, a broad trend that, you know, everybody who does this gets this experience that is negative and affects their career. And I'm not a social scientist, so I don't want to dive too much into that, but that is what I found.
What about years ago, are you familiar with Mary Lynn Dittmar, Dr. Dittmar?
Oh, yes, I know Mary Lynn. She's a wonderful person, and I'm really glad to know her.
Okay, so years ago, when I first met her, and she was on the space show two or three times, she did studies about younger people, and these would be, I guess, the group that's older than millennials. I don't know what they'd be called, but millennials would have still been babies.
Probably. Generation X.
Yeah, maybe Gen X. And she inquired about their wanting to go to Mars. And we did lots of programming on her surveys, and they were not the least bit interested in going to Mars. It was a very big percentage that said no real reason to go to Mars. They could experience Mars and space travel virtually, but they don't care that much about going. Was asking them about their own personal human spaceflight plans, going to Mars, space settlement, anything like that, was that part of what you asked them in your interviews?
Yeah, absolutely. And I got a wide range of answers, and it was about evenly split between Moon and Mars. Very few people didn't want to do any of that. Very few people thought that there should not be any human spaceflight. The vast majority did, and I don't recall off the top of my head what percentages that was, but it was overwhelming that yes, they supported human spaceflight, and yes, it was worth the risk, and yes, we should be going and exploring, and it's human nature, and all the arguments that we are used to hearing. That resounded with the people that I interviewed, and I can only think of very few people who had the opposite perspective, where we shouldn't be.
So that
in those cases, they were... It was actually, for one case, it was an environmental concern. You know, how can we go out into the other planets when we haven't taken care of our own planet? You know, that kind of perspective. Not the kind of perspective like we shouldn't go because why should we bother or why should we waste the money? It was more like we need to be more responsible as a human species before we go.
So that's pretty much opposite of what Mary Lynn found out. And to me, the factor that is most changed, and of course I have no evidence to back this up, is SpaceX, because SpaceX came on the horizon from Marianne's time with that Mars research to what you're doing, and I honestly believe that Musk and SpaceX changed the entire space culture going forward from when he came on the scene.
I found that as well, especially with the international clients that I have. You know, NASA has always been a global brand, and now SpaceX is also a global brand. And even if someone is not well-versed in space at all, even if they follow it only bits and pieces and news, they still know SpaceX. Like, that is just a company that has stuck in everyone's minds and encouraged their imagination, and I love that.
You have Jerry in Tucson's got our first email today, and he says, I have found your website under Astrolytical. I don't see how we can get your book. Do we have to support your crowdfunding program? David said it's already funded. Is that how you get your book, or how and when will we be able to get your book?
Thank you for the question. Yeah, forgive me. We kind of glossed over that. I have not updated the website yet just because I've had other priorities, whereas I'm going to put a landing page for the book that it's going to include the Amazon.com pre-order page. and the link to the Kickstarter. So if you go to Kickstarter right now, you can find it. If you just type in space, you'll find it. It's currently, it was funded within 2 hours, so I was shocked about that. I was pleasantly surprised, but it's still going. I had it set up for a month, and I started it on January 17th, so it's still going until mid-February. And you can choose to order it on Kickstarter by supporting the Kickstarter campaign. That gets you extra perks, which you can read about on the website, on the Kickstarter website, or you can pre-order it on Amazon. I'm also looking into an audiobook through Audible, but I haven't gotten those details set yet, and I was sort of waiting to have all of that finalized before putting it on the landing page, and I just need to go do that.
So I'm going to ask you a somewhat personal question. If you don't want to answer it, don't answer it. But I'm on your Kickstarter page. I actually printed it out for the show. And you were trying to raise, it looks like, $1,000, and you raised, a third more than that. So, and you told me before we started the show that you were publishing a book yourself. So I'm assuming this money goes for publishing the books. How in the hell, tell me your secret of how you published a book for such a low price.
I have a friend who's a scientific editor, and the majority of the money that I'm raising is going to go to him and his editing of the book and all that. So I'm going through a friend, and that's going to help, but I'm going to pay him, you know. I was planning on paying an artist for the book cover, and then I had a friend who I did the first draft on Photoshop with my very limited skills, and I posted it on my personal Facebook page, which isn't open to the public. It's just a friends and family only page. And she, I was surprised, she's a chemist, but she just has fun on Photoshop. So she fixed it up for me and told her to buy her a meal. So there's that. I also might, depending on how much the Kickstarter raises, I might add more art within the book. But at this point, I haven't looked into an artist for that, so I did not include that in the $1,000 that I was planning to raise. At the ISBNs, I'm going to buy a pack of 10. That's $300, because I already have an idea for my next book. So I might as well go ahead and buy that now and have that package. So you need one ISBN for the hard the physical copy. You need one for the ebook. And then I think you need one for the audiobook as well. So there's three that I use for this book, and it only comes in one or a pack of 10. So I'm going to buy a pack of 10. And then the rest of it, like, you can spend money on marketing, but I didn't include that because I'm just going to go use social media and word of mouth. I could buy ad space. I could if I raise enough money. I don't know. There's no limit to how expensive it can be, but because Kickstarter is an all-or-nothing campaign, I was going for the bare minimum. That way I could get it.
And you said your son is a scientific editor?
Not my son. No. My son is only 1 year old.
Oh.
My friend.
Oh,
my
friend
is a scientific editor, yes. He owns his own business, and he does scientific editing.
So at some point after the show, I would love for you to introduce him to me, because I'm looking for editors for a space show book.
And, he doesn't usually do books, but I'm sure he'd help you out.
Well, he may give me some ideas, but it's not really scientific, but there is a lot of science and engineering and science wording and concepts and stuff like that that will be in it. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. What kind of consulting do you do? Are you mostly working with startups, or how do you focus your consulting efforts?
It's a mix. So I do have clients that are startups. I also am a subject matter expert for NASA for planetary science missions. And I've done work for local government as well, for Camden County, Georgia, which is building its own spaceport. I also have a lot of individual clients, whether that's individual for a smaller project, such as like a video game I helped out with, or I also do space career coaching. So a lot of individual clients who come to me, either as students or fresh graduates or mid-level professionals who want to switch careers, and guide them through that process. So it's a mix. I'd certainly like more of the bigger clients, if anyone's listening, but I actually like the diversity. It's one of the great things about owning my own company, is I love the diversity of the clients that I have.
So are you actually working on getting the Georgia spaceport approval done and going through that process?
I am not part of the FAA's EIS process. EIS okay. is the environmental impact statement to get that approved, and it takes years. I'm not part of that, but I am on their I'm actually chairing their education board, and that's a volunteer position where I'm just helping out in any way that I can encourage the Southeast Georgia community to promote STEM education.
Does it look good for that spaceport? Can you?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's a news article that came out last week about a Georgia Tech student team that's going to be doing a test launch down in Georgia this year, down in Camden County. And there's other news that's forthcoming, so keep an eye out for that. So I don't know the status of the EIS when that's actually going to be approved, but in the meantime, they're doing a great job with encouraging companies to come. And the idea is they're going to do a research and innovation park, and so encouraging small businesses to come and locate there and get some high-tech jobs.
Carolyn is in Seattle, and she says, I know what NASA ambassadors and other titles like that are, but I'm not familiar with what a subject matter expert is. Can you please explain that?
Sure. So when NASA puts out a call for missions, they speak to the civilian engineer community, and they put together, through universities or companies or nonprofits or research institutions, they put together these great proposals for NASA missions. And then NASA needs people to come in and review those proposals. And that is what I help do. I did this for the International Space Station through CASIS, which they now call themselves ISS,
right.
National Lab. So I worked for CASIS, and I did this for physical science experiments on the International Space Station that benefit life on Earth. And now I do it for planetary science missions. So it's a great planetary science that NASA does. That's what I focus on. Any proposals that come in that fit the criteria that match my expertise, I'm part of a team that then looks at those proposals, grades them, evaluates them, pours through them, tries to figure out which ones should get funded.
I didn't even know that program existed. How do you get to be part of that?
Quite honest, I didn't know it existed either. So I was recruited through LinkedIn last year. There's a contract through Langley Research Center that is awarded to a company called CTS, and they're just a contractor, and they find the subject matter experts, and they might still be looking. So I can send you the link, and you can post it if you'd like. I don't know. I haven't looked since last year.
Yeah,
but
I'll,
they're always looking for people with the right expertise to match their needs.
I'll post it on our blog for this show, and there may be people interested. I don't think we've ever heard about that on the space show before. So you've given us a first in nearly 18 years.
Yeah, I was surprised too, because I come from a scientific background where most of these, at least papers, peer-reviewed papers, are volunteers. And so I assumed that either it was NASA internal people or volunteers who did those criteria, who did the reviewing and the evaluating. But because these are such huge missions, and it ranges, of course, some of them are smaller than others, but because it's so much money and there's so much involved that, you know, they wanted to get an independent team put together.
Really very, very interesting. What, again, we've never talked about that or heard about that on the Space Shell program. You have another note from Alex, who is in Denver. Alex says, I'm curious as to how you see the emerging commercial space industry evolve vis-a-vis lunar policy and lunar programs. Many of us think the government is on the wrong foot with things like the Gateway and not going to the surface of the moon for a long, long time, if ever. I'm curious how you see that. Many of us do want to get back to the moon with people, and we just see it being stonewalled by what NASA is doing in other projects.
So NASA is a government agency that is under the White House, and the executive branch, they decide what the policy is. And so you can't blame NASA so much as you have to blame the fact that there's not a cohesive policy. The Trump administration has come in with various initiatives and declared that we are going to put humans, you know, feet on the moon, right? So
right.
Astronauts are going to be on the moon. That was Space Policy Directive 1, signed, what was it, almost 2 years ago now. So that is the official policy from the White House. Then comes the other side of things, Congress, which funds these things. And that's often where the disconnect is. You can't just have an initiative without it being funded, or else it's never going to happen. And we see this repeated throughout decades now of NASA's projects and programs. Whether Gateway is the right way to do it, whether you go, you know, from Earth to Gateway and then down to the surface, that's debatable. I'm on the side where I'd rather go straight down, personally speaking. I can understand the benefits of having a Cislunar Gateway. And for those who aren't familiar, we're talking about what used to be called LOPD and has changed names a few times, where they've decided to do a smaller station outpost that is in Cislunar space, somewhere in the vicinity of the moon, where we can sometimes have it, you know, stationed with people, and sometimes it won't be. I'm personally of the perspective where we should, I don't know if accelerate is the right word, but we should be more aggressive in what we're trying to do. But then you get the partnerships that come in, and hopefully with continued partnerships like the contracts that were awarded last year, the end of last year, to a bunch of smaller companies and to Lockheed Martin, a larger company, to get small landers down to the moon, as well as some of the remaining Google Lunar XPRIZE companies, as well as partnerships with other countries. Now, we've been only talking about United States policy. If you look elsewhere, European Space Agency is very interested in sending people to the moon. So is China, so is Russia, although Russia doesn't have a lot of funds to do that. But if we have enough partnerships, maybe eventually some momentum will happen. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the momentum. I don't see it yet. It's getting closer. It is much closer now than it ever has been, but it's still not there. For there to be momentum, we need to have tangible success and funding behind it. And it doesn't have to be just government funding. It could be private funding as well. And that's what I'm looking for. I don't know if that fully answered your question. You can send a follow-up note.
You and thousands of others are looking for that.
I personally would love to go to the moon. That's been my passion since I was in third grade, is going to the moon. And so I am waiting for that moment where we are finally committed as a human species to getting down there, whether it is the United States government, whether it's a private company, whether it's somebody else. I want to see it happen, and then the rest will follow.
Well, I would go to the moon, too, because I'm claustrophobic, and I might be able to handle 3 days, you know, to get there. If the habitat, you could walk around and do some things in it, and then you come back. I'm not interested in a one-way trip to any place, although I realize at 72 I'm facing a one-way trip sometime in the future. But I'd rather do the moon, I think, than Mars, although I think Mars would be really, really fun. But I'd be gone from my kids and my dog for a really long time, and I don't want to do that.
So, I hear. I am sympathetic to the people who want to go to Mars and think that's a higher priority and want to do Mars direct rather than stopping at the moon. And I understand that perspective, but technically, we're not there yet. You know, we can get the engineering together with the rocket, but if you're talking about people, it's much more complex.
Yeah, I agree with you.
We haven't really figured out all of the little details yet, in my opinion. Doesn't mean someone shouldn't try. And by all means, if you're a billionaire, go ahead and fund the mission to Mars. You know, no one's stopping you. But I do think the moon is more realistic. I like the plan that came out by Bob Zubrin about moon direct. I rather liked that perspective. I think it's simpler. Whereas the Gateway adds more complexity, in my opinion. I also am a fan of the fuel depot concept, but I do think that'll be a later concept and not the initial architecture.
Jack is in Marina Del Rey, which is actually near the airport, sort of in Los Angeles. And he said earlier, you mentioned when talking about your book, Millennials and Moon Mars. Do the millennials have a bigger percentage preferring going to the moon, doing the gate? Well, the Gateway didn't exist when you were doing the book. I'm just reading Jack's email. Or going to Mars. Could you discern a difference in terms of the numbers supporting the moon over Mars?
As a scientist, it was tempting for me to go ahead and do those kinds of percentages, but when you're talking about 100 people, those are small number statistics, and they mean something, but they don't mean a whole lot, and it's hard to generalize based on just 100 people. And so I resisted the temptation to do exactly what you're asking. I did not want to ask, you know, survey everyone and say, which ones want to go to the moon, which ones want to go to Mars. I was more interested in the why. what captivates their imagination at this place or that place? What do they think is possible? One of the final questions I asked is, what do you think that the millennial generation will accomplish? So that gets them out of generalities and speculation and more into tangible results. And that got me a different perspective as to what the people I interviewed actually thought was going to happen in the next couple of decades. And, you know, that gave a different spin on it, because even the people who were more interested in Mars, some of them didn't think that we could get there within by the time millennials retired. And so they gave a more incremental answer to that question where, okay, even if we don't get to Mars before I retire, I would still like us to go to the moon and set up, you know, the infrastructure, whatever. So, it is hard to, especially since some of them were fans of both of them and mentioned both of them in their answers to me. And so you can't really pit one against the other because that's not the way I structure the questions, and it's not the way most people think. I would love to go step one on the moon. I would also love to go to Mars someday, but my priority is the moon, not only because I've been captivated since a kid, but also because I think that's the more realistic possibility within my lifetime.
What about...
Doesn't mean I'm not a Mars fan, though.
What about people talking space settlement, for example, going to the moon, but part of a permanent lunar base or something of that nature? Did that come up in your questioning?
Yeah, several people mentioned that, and I did not ask the questions very specifically. I kept it open on purpose so that people would write what they were passionate about, write what they were interested in, write what came to their mind. And so I kept it very general, where I didn't ask them specifically about human settlement. I kept it open where I was asking them to tell me what they were interested in, what they were passionate about, what captivated them at this moment about space. And human settlement came up a lot. It wasn't a constant thing where every single person talked about it, but it was a natural, logical progression in the minds of most people that I talked with.
I wouldn't have expected you're going to get this question, but okay, well, I'll do it. Sally is in Reno, Nevada, and she says, David does a lot of shows dealing with interstellar flight technology, breakthrough, things of that nature, plus the searching for life signals, biosignatures, technosignatures, etc. Did the millennials at all talk about or reference looking for extraterrestrial life? Do they have any thoughts about that, concepts about that?
Actually, yes. I interviewed a wide range of people, including astrobiologists, and every astrobiologist I spoke with mentioned search for biosignatures and extraterrestrial life, and because that is their motivator, right? Everybody wants to be the person who discovers, or the team that discovers, or even alive when we find life outside of Earth. And it's just natural for that to be that motivator for astrobiologists. And so even astronomers who don't focus on astrobiology, some of them mentioned it as well. So absolutely. Also mentioned were new propulsion techniques, and so that comes into the interstellar propulsion. So while no one that I interviewed was directly working on those kinds of advanced technologies, some of them were very interested in it.
Yeah, and that's kind of a problem. There's not a whole lot of people or money being devoted to working on those technologies. So, you know, it kind of remains theoretical and academic and not well-funded, as well as some other projects that get a lot more attention. I have a big interest in Interstellar. I wish it was a top priority, but...
I hear you. You know, I hope so, too. And that takes a lot of focus that our government doesn't usually have.
I guess so. That would be a nice, gentle way of saying that. So you're a millennial, and you interviewed all these millennials. I'm curious as to a timeline that your group, if you can do this, think would be reasonable for not necessarily suborbital human flight, but truly returning to orbital human spaceflight beyond LEO. So that would be cislunar development, the moon, Mars, maybe some other destination, an asteroid or something. Is this something that we're going to see in 10 years? Is it going to take a lot longer to have legitimate beyond LEO human spaceflight?
I can't speak for the specifics of your question, but I can speak in more generalities, because okay, I asked people what they thought was going to happen within their careers. whether or not they were directly working on it. And the majority of people thought that we would progress outside of Leo. Most people would say that we would end up going, humans would land on the moon again. Few people said Mars, so not that many. And it's just based on, I think, the perspectives of the people that I interviewed, how directly that they're working on these things, that they can determine the realities of the situation and their perspectives for engineering versus science versus an outside, a communicator who is writing about these things or, outreach to the public and needing to know it in broad terms. And I think that it just depended on their optimism as well. And most people were very optimistic, but a few people were pessimistic. And I did not ask about, within the next 10 years or the next 20. I didn't ask that kind of specific question. And I think that the answer would change depending on when I asked that question as well. Since I asked those questions, you mentioned that the gateway wasn't a thing back in 2016. Well, now it is an idea that is being pursued. The asteroid mining companies, they were big back in 2016. Now they're not, now they're not so much doing asteroid mining as directly. Some of them, there are still some asteroid mining or moon or Mars, mining efforts, but it's not as big as it was in 2016. So things change and evolve, and they evolve actually fairly quickly. And so I think that even if I had asked that question, it wouldn't be relevant today.
This is Wanda, and Wanda's in Chicago, and she says, I'm looking at your astrolytical website. Do you speak before non-space audience groups? And if so, I'm really curious as to their genuine interest in space, if you can tell, but more so their actual knowledge and maybe expertise or quasi-expertise in space, science, and STEM topics.
Since you're on my website, there's one page for public speaking, and then there's another page for STEM education outreach. And so I speak a lot to students, ranging from middle school through university level. And I speak a little bit to the general public as well. I just spoke a couple of weeks ago to a science cafe in North Georgia. And they were a mix of people. Most of them are not scientists, although some of them were because the University of North Georgia is right there. But it was, generally speaking, just a public audience that didn't necessarily have a background in space or even science and engineering. And they were the most enthusiastic people I think I've ever spoken with. I was just kind of blown away at their interest in their questions and how many people spoke to me afterwards. And it was wonderful, to be honest with you, because I don't usually get that much enthusiasm and interest, especially since I do speak with students a lot, and that's always a mixed bag. People are fascinated by space. You don't want to get into the weeds so much when you're talking about the general public. You want to keep it more broad. Realistic, yes. You don't want it to be science fiction presentation unless that's your goal. But you don't want to get too technical. So I try to find that balance where people are super interested, but I don't lose them. And people are really, really interested. Most of my friends and family, they hear about space all the time from me. And I hope that they don't get too bothered by the things I speak about, because I never stop talking about space. In fact, I watched the most recent the most recent Blue Origin launch a couple of days ago from the dentist chair, because they had delayed that from a Monday to a Wednesday, and then from 9:50 Eastern time to 10:10 Eastern time, and that got me to my dentist chair, and I was watching it on my phone, and my dentist paused and watched it with me. And so people just love space. She was asking me all these questions about, what was flying and what it was doing. And I love outreach to people and spontaneously like that. People are very interested when you get them, off guard and talk to them about what's really happening.
So your dentist has TV for watching space stuff?
No. I was on my phone.
I had my iPhone
out in front of me, laying on the chair. We paused whatever she was doing in my mouth and and watched the launch.
Well, cool that I think they do have that interest. I don't know how deep that interest is, but I do think a lot of people are interested. But it's really easy to lose them if you get too technical. And so
yeah.
you're right on that. This is probably something that's happened to me way too many times. Is you get into something really technical and they drift off. So you have to one has to be careful about. Do you have a favorite topic when you speak to a non-space audience that you like to talk about?
It depends on the focus of the talk, but my favorite would be talking about the future of human space exploration. And so I talk about what's already happened in terms of who's flying and how often they're flying and where they're going, and a little bit about the space tourism that's already happened with Space Adventures and the International Space Station. And then from there, I bridge into the future plans. I talk about, you know, the Falcon 9 and the Commercial Crew Program and Boeing. And then I talk about, you know, Virgin Galactic and the suborbital and, you know, Blue Origin and some of those other fun things that will happen in the next couple of years. But I also like to bridge out a little farther, and especially with students, I like to get them thinking about what would you take with you if you had to go to the moon or Mars or an asteroid? What would you take with you? What would you do there? What would you need to build or grow or accomplish there? And I've done a lot with ISRU, especially back in grad school. My focus was the regolith. So I looked at lunar regolith, Martian regolith, and asteroid regolith simulants, and I really focused on how do you use the dirt and dust and all the other stuff that the minerals, whatever is on the surface that you are on, how do you use it? And so that's what I really like to talk to the kids about is, okay, trying to picture them. Because that's what happened with me. That's what got me involved, is that I wrote a short story back in third grade about what would I take with me to the moon and what would we do there. And so I think if you get a kid thinking about, or anybody, thinking about what they personally would do, that puts them in the shoes of an astronaut, a future explorer, and that captures their imagination.
What did you say you would take with you to the moon in third grade?
Oh, gosh. I know I took a bucket and a helmet and a shovel, and I don't remember the rest of the story. I don't remember, but it's on my blog from like 3 years ago. I'd have to go dig back and see what I wrote.
So you were going to do some excavation on the moon?
Apparently so. That's what my 9-year-old self wanted to do.
When I introduced you, I read that you had been working with Swiss Space, and I think you reminded me that we had met when I wanted you to do a show about Swiss Space, but that never worked out. So Swiss Space is no longer, correct?
They are in the final stages of bankruptcy back in Switzerland. Swiss Space Systems USA is a separate subsidiary, and that hasn't existed for years. 3 years, in fact. I cleared out the Kennedy Space Center office 3 years ago in December, right before my first child was born. So that sticks in my mind very well about when that officially or unofficially ended. The bankruptcy proceedings have been ongoing because Swiss Space Systems, specifically the CEO, has been fighting it. But just a week or two ago, they finally gave up and agreed to become bankrupt.
Okay, so that's gone. And I want to talk to you before we end the show about your interest in suborbital space, because I also read about your having gone through the NASTAR program. But you have a caller on hold, so I'm going to jump forward to our caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. How are you? Who are you? And where are you? Caller, are you there? Hello, caller. They're still there because they haven't hung up. Caller, are you there? Okay, going once, twice, three times. Okay, caller. You need to be there when we answer the phone. So if you want to call back, please do call back. It is 1-866-687-7223. Suborbital space. You clearly have an interest in that. Would you like to take suborbital rides?
Absolutely. I would love to. In fact, one of the things I think about when I come about the future of space travel, I still want to be an astronaut. And I think, you know, my dream is the moon, but I think the most realistic path for me to be an astronaut is a private astronaut through a suborbital company. And so maybe, you know, a couple decades out, in 20, 30 years, maybe I can both afford it, and maybe it'll be a more realistic option where anybody can buy a ticket, not just the very wealthy. But I want to buy my kids a ticket. You know, my husband's already told me now he doesn't want to go. But, you know, if any of my kids want to go, my grandkids, if it's that, you know, that point, then I want to be able to take a flight with them. I have been involved in the suborbital community since grad school. I am part of the team that helped organize and run the Next Generation Suborbital Researchers Conference, which is a every other year conference in Colorado. And it's really interesting to find the progress and the different perspectives and the different feel. You know, I remember not too long ago, people were a little down because certain companies were laying off people or not succeeding, whereas the last one, which was about a year ago in December, as a matter of fact, that one had a much more optimistic feel. And so while I don't personally work on suborbital research directly anymore, I still absolutely am fascinated by the progress that's being made, and I want to be a customer someday.
This is another question for you. Linda is in Phoenix, Arizona, and Linda says, it appears that there might be two options for suborbital flight. One is Blue Origin and the other is Virgin. Blue Origin interests me because there's no crew on board. It's all remote and I guess AI. Would you do a suborbital flight without a crew?
Oh, I would absolutely take a Blue Origin flight. Have you seen how stable and happy Skywalker mannequin looks when he takes a blue flight?
But it's a mannequin.
I have that team and what they've done with those flights. And you're leaving out SpaceX. SpaceX has said that they want to do point-to-point transportation through suborbital space. And so they're another player. Whether or not they decide to focus on that, I don't know. But they're another player who's put their hat in a ring for suborbital. And a few other companies as well, some smaller companies. I would go without a crew. I would go with a crew. I don't think for me personally, I would be that picky. But what I would want to do is not be the first customer. I'm not even the top 100 customers. I think I'd want to wait. For my personal, perspective on risk, I'm happy that other people want to take those first flights. I'm going to wait.
So you want them to be seasoned flyers before you get on that space capsule or get in.
Well, even 100 flights isn't a seasoned flyer. But, I'm just hoping that as the technology progresses and we get more comfortable with doing these suborbital human flights, we just had a great success with Virgin a couple months ago now. Was it November? And
yes.
So I'm really, really excited to see their progress because they've been quite slow. And so I'm really hoping that they're doing it right. Slow isn't necessarily bad when it comes to the safety of humans, although I do know other people who think that we should be, full steam ahead. When it comes to humans, I do think that it's okay to be slow as long as your investors are okay with going slow and your customers that have already purchased tickets in the case of Virgin.
Have you taken advantage of any of the very high altitude military jet flights where you can see the curvature of the Earth?
Oh, I would love to do that. No. In fact, we just rewatched First Man the other day with the X-15 flights. Oh, my gosh, that was beautiful. Wouldn't want to, be in a dangerous flight like that. But, absolutely. I would go on to a near space flight, whether that's an airplane or a balloon. I would do that as well. But with those flights, I think my purpose would be different because I have done two zero-G campaigns. Well, one of them is through Zero-G Corporation. The other one was through NASA. And that gives you a totally different perspective on the concept of gravity. When you switch gravity off in a sense, that gives you, a different way of thinking about what gravity is and what it does to the human body and how we move. Whereas a near space flight, especially on a balloon, you don't get that. You get the beautiful curvature of the Earth. If you're strapped into an airplane and you can't let go, maybe you can see a pen or something fly around, but you're still strapped in. You can't do a somersault. You can't experience the full greatness, beauty, wonder of microgravity. And so my opinion would be that I more want to do a research flight, a balloon or a near space vehicle rather than a tourism flight, which if I'm going to do a tourism flight, I want to do a somersault.
You want to do a somersault?
Absolutely.
Well, I guess you need the room to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bob is in Memphis with an email, and I know we're coming up toward the end of the show. So listeners and caller who tried to call a few minutes ago, there's still time if you want to try again. 1-866-687-7223. Bob has an interesting question, I think. And he says, I'm curious as to how you decide between, say, suborbital and orbital, other than cost, how you evaluate risk, how you would assess, say, the risk or the value of a Blue Origin trip toward a Virgin trip. What would make you choose one or the other?
Ooh, that could be an entire phone call by itself. There's a lot of factors that go into your question. And it all depends on what your criteria is. What is your goal? If it is a, you know, I just want to have fun kind of flight, that's one company or one method of getting up there. If it's a research flight and you've got certain criteria for your research, maybe your project only needs 10 seconds of microgravity or a minute of microgravity or 5 minutes of microgravity, or maybe it needs longer. And this is assuming that it's a human-tended mission and not an automated mission that can just be sent up on a non-crewed, non-passenger vehicle. But if you're up there with it and it needs to be up there for a certain length of time or you need to do something, then that's going to factor into your criteria. Most of these research flights are now funded through NASA or through some other means. NASA has an entire program office that deals with funding research payloads, and it's fantastic that they've allowed it, that they've opened that up to suborbital research flights, and they are going to open it up to human-tended research flights as well. So it's progressing slowly, but it is progressing. And it really all depends on what you want to do. For me personally, I'm not made of money. So I'm just going to assume that a couple of decades from now, both I can afford it by saving up and the flights will come down in price. And then from that point, it would likely be, if I can afford it personally, it would be a for fun tourism flight. If I'm flying a payload, a research payload, I am a scientist and I do have ideas of really awesome research that could be done in microgravity conditions, that has a different criteria, and it all depends on the experiment that I want to do.
This is probably going to be the final question of the day, unless we get an 11th hour email or...
I don't have a hard cutoff, so it's okay if we go a little over.
Okay. Larry is in Boston. And he says, I'm also on your website, and I notice you do career coaching. That might be interesting for many of us that are coming upon graduating or thinking of wanting to work in the field. Can you tell us a little bit about your space career coaching? Is it for engineering? Is it in general? Is it specific for something?
Yeah, I'm glad that that piqued your interest. It is open to any individual in any field who is either a student or a recent graduate or a mid-level professional who wants to switch fields. So I focus a lot on a mix of the STEM fields as well as some non-traditional fields that want to switch over. Some recent examples have been lawyers or oil and gas technician or there's just been a wide range, actually. Who am I working with right now? So I don't want to get too specific. But it's communicators. I've definitely worked with a few people who have been writers or, in other ways communicating with the general public, and they want to get deeper into the technical, or they want to figure out how they have their skill set match a space career. And so I do work with a range of students. I don't work with any high schoolers, but universities through grad school students, as well as recent graduates and professionals who just want a space career. They want to work somewhere involved in space, and they just don't know how, or they don't know the right path for them, or they're on a path and it's not the right way for them to go, and they want to figure out what should they be doing differently? How can they be more successful? Maybe it is the right path for them, but they are struggling along the way. And so this was something that I came up with a few years ago because I had so many people interested in being mentored by me that I sort of had to develop a way to dive deeper into each person, because I felt that I wasn't able through just standard mentoring to dive into people's lives and to really help them figure out exactly how they can move forward, what paths they can take. So this was a way to give me an excuse to dive into people's lives in a much deeper, more meaningful way and help them as an individual rather than just general advice. And it's gotten way more interest than I thought when I first started. It's a very hot topic. I take on international clients, so people around the world coming to me asking me how they can work in space, and I find that very motivating that people are really excited about our field.
Are you seeing opportunities for space careers opening up and increasing? Is it stagnant? And where do you see most of the opportunities?
Oh, it's absolutely increasing. Now, we have had some, big layoffs recently in at least four different companies. That's unfortunate. But in general, it's broadening. So you've got the traditional space, businesses. You've got, you know, the SATCOM and, you know, the big companies that you almost take for granted are space, but yeah, they're space companies. And then you've got the more emerging, exciting, you know, what captures people's imagination, anything from launch vehicles to some of the more out there technologies. And anything in between, science as well. So if you're a researcher and you want to study, you know, anything to do with astronomy, planetary science, astrobiology, chemistry, any science that touches space, which hint all of them do in some way or another. In fact, almost any discipline touches space in some way or another. And that's one of the things that I first work with when I work with more the non-traditional person, is that convincing them that, yes, they've got fantastic experience as an IT professional, and they can use that IT skill to work in a space company. So yeah, it's one of those things where the jobs are out there. Most people just don't know where to look, or even if they do know the way to look, they don't know the right way to jump in there. They make a lot of mistakes, or they just don't know the people, so I help with introductions, help out with conferences, getting them involved in the community, whether that's directly in person through conference or whether that's, you know, diving in on LinkedIn or elsewhere. So just making sure that people know where the opportunities are, because they're out there.
Do you help with resume creation for the space industry?
So that's not my primary objective, but if someone has a resume that they want me to look at, then I absolutely do help them.
You have a caller. Let's see if they're with us this time. I guess not. I mean, whoever is calling, they're not showing up on my caller ID, so I can't see who it is. But caller, if you want to try again, there's still time. 1-866-687-7223. It's probably someone using a digital line that doesn't work with my equipment, and they're having a hard time with it. How about networking? Like, do you get a listing of aerospace jobs available and you work to maybe fill such and such a job at such and such a company?
I don't do recruiting.
So you don't do recruiting.
That would be somebody else's full-time job. In fact, there are space recruiters out there. No, that is not my area of expertise. But what I do help them with is my goal is to get them the tools that they need, so that they don't need me. And so I help them figure out how do they find the jobs that they want? How do they dive into the companies or find the companies that interest them?
What are the most, from what you can tell, sought after degrees and experience level? Does it come out of the engineering disciplines, or are the science degrees really sought after? Can you ascertain, you know, where the real interest lies? If someone's thinking, I want to go into space, but what should I study?
I really try to stay away from guiding people as to what they should study, because space is so broad. In fact, I had a teacher recently talking to a classroom. They wanted me to talk about the value of STEM careers, or STEM education, I should say. And they wanted me to talk about what science and technology they should major in college. And I turned that on its head and I said, no, you absolutely should not major in a STEM field if that's not your interest. Because whatever you're interested in, that is where you're going to thrive. And whether it takes you, you know, I'm not the best. I've never been the best student in the world. I always struggled through school. I struggled through tests. I was never a straight A student. And so even if you are struggling through whatever chosen field you've chosen in, if you're passionate and interested about, you will succeed eventually. You will graduate. And then whatever that is, you can find a way to work in space. So whether that is, you know, standard aerospace engineering, or whether that is something completely off the wall, like culinary art, you can still find a way to tie that into space, because NASA employs cooks that cook for astronauts. And they have whole programs where they try to figure out how best to, you know, have space, prepare food in space. And so really whatever field you're passionate in, that's where you need to go study and learn. And then you figure out how to tie that to space after the fact, or even better, while you're in school. That way you can get connections, experience through internships or projects, and all the great things that we tell students to do.
Where do you see this emerging space industry 10 years from now? Will it still be emerging, or what do you think?
Oh, gosh. Well, the word emerging implies that there's always going to be emerging companies, right? What I try to do as an analyst is I stay away from the hype. I absolutely do not trust companies that hype up their own products and services. So there's one company in particular I'm thinking of right now was doing a crowdfunding campaign to raise millions of dollars for their spaceship their orbital, their space station program. And I'm like, yeah, no. So you might have a small company like that eventually grow and succeed. And I wouldn't believe, for example, in SpaceX, and yet you see SpaceX succeeding, right? So smaller startups will grow and become established companies, but most of them won't. Most of the small startups will fail. And so what I do is I look to see what's more realistic. Where is this company coming from? Who are the people involved? Where's the money coming from? What's their time scale and their goals? And you can almost tell right away whether or not these are people who should be taken seriously or not. And I do a lot of those deep dives into companies and figure out, you know, if are they going to succeed? And are they going to be around in 10 years? And it's kind of fun, actually, to try to predict that. So I couldn't tell you exactly what the field's going to look like in 10 years, but I can tell you that we are going to have more human spaceflight activity. We're going to have more established launch record with more launch cadence. We're going to have more CubeSat, small sat launching, because that is where the industry is going with miniaturization. And we're going to have more discussions about space situational awareness and space traffic management, because that's going to be a big issue with all the small sats that are launching. And I think that you can almost see the pattern of where things are going just by where they are right now and the conversations that we're having. And I don't discount the fact that some brand new company is going to start tomorrow and change the way we all think, because that's exactly what SpaceX did, right? So you can never discount what we don't already know, and we'll pop up tomorrow.
Fascinating. What's next on your horizon? You have your book, and then what?
I'm working on a addition to Astrolytical, which is going to focus on space hot topics that will be sort of like a small summaries of what's going on in that hot topic. And off the top of my head, like, I'm working on the Dear Moon project right now, or Space Force. So, you know, those hot topics that people are interested in, I'm going to dive into them and summarize them and analyze them in a very short, concise manner for the general public, as well as for the space-interested crowd. So these will be things that will appeal to people who are working in the industry, but especially people who are, you know, maybe communicators within the industry, or teachers, or anybody who really doesn't know already what the Space Force is and they want to get a background on that, you know, something like that. And that's going to be a wide range of topics, ranging from science and engineering to some of the more businessy topics. And that's going to be added. I had told myself this spring, but now I've got the book coming out in spring. So I don't yet know the timeline of when I'm going to add that. But that'll be starting out with about 25 hot topics, and then increase. I want to get it to at least 100 topics by the end of the year. And I have a list of over 100, so that's easy to do. I already have my second book idea. It's going to be about space tourism and becoming an astronaut in a different perspective than what's been looked at previously. So I'm going to sort of dive into some existing astronauts' perspective on that, but I have not started that because I told myself I was not going to start that book until I got the first book out. And so I can't tell you anything about that book other than the general idea of it. And if you're an astronaut and you want to be involved in this book, please let me know. But I'll probably start that in the spring. Beyond that, I'm just hoping that Astrolytical will continue to grow.
Is there something we should have talked about or mentioned with your crowdfunding program, or anything that we have omitted or forgotten, or that you would like to be sure we covered and talked about?
No, I think we covered all of it. It's not too late to fund the Kickstarter, but like I said, it's already funded, so you can go on the Kickstarter for the extra perks if you want. You can go see what they are, you know, autographed copy or being thanked in the book, things like that. But if you just want to pre-order it, I will have the Amazon page up soon. That way you can just go online and pay the standard price for an ebook or a physical book through Amazon. And I'm working on getting an audiobook. Never done that, never even thought about that before until, you know, a couple weeks ago. So those details will come out soon.
Would the audiobook be you reading it, or would you have to get someone to read it?
I don't know how much it costs to hire a voice actor, so I'd probably do it myself, but it seems like a lot of time commitment. So, again, I haven't really figured that out yet. But I do want to make, you know, accessibility is something that is important to me. So I want to make it so that everybody can consume the book, whether they read it with their eyes or listen to it with their ears.
It is really hard to read books in public. I mean, my hat goes off to those people. I know what it's like to read just a two-paragraph email on air on the show. So,
I get a lot of practice reading to my kids, but that's not quite the same thing.
No, hardly. But my hat goes off to people who read books on tape and things like that, because it is really a thing. And if you read it yourself, it's a lot of time practicing. It's probably 3 to 4 hours for every hour of recording time in practicing, I would imagine. So that's
going to be determined in the future as I figure out what this is involved in. It's going to take a little longer to come out, so it's not going to, you know, it's not going to be an audio book that comes out along with the physical book or the ebook. You'll have to wait a little bit longer. But since the Kickstarter did so well, I think that I have that incentive to go and make that a stretch goal.
Well, I'm interested in your book. Let me know when it comes out, and when it's out, maybe we can do another show about it, and I'll have the book in hand, and we can talk for an hour specifically about the book, and I would look forward to that.
Sounds great. Thanks, David.
Okay. Listeners, that's going to be it. We're a little over the 1 hour and a little before the 90 minutes. And I want to thank Laura for being with us and those of you who emailed us, and for our mystery caller, I'm sorry you weren't able to connect. We have a full week on the show, and another author is our guest tomorrow, Rod Pyle, and check him out tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Open Lines is on Sunday. Any topic is welcome as long as it's space or science or STEM related, and we want all phone calls, so do call us on Sunday, Open Lines. So everybody have a great week and make it a safe week. Keep looking up, and goodbye from Laura, goodbye from David, and The Space Show.